Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with W.K. Stratton about his new book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood, and the Making of a Legendary Film. The book was published in 2019 by Bloomsbury Publishing. Peckinpah is an important filmmaker who worked as the Hollywood studio system began to break down. The Wild Bunch, released 50 years ago, became an important catalyst for the change and illustrated how directors and writers chose to ignore the old rules related to sex and violence. Kip Stratton's book describes how Peckinpah had to break an informal Hollywood blacklist related to his many personal issues to create an original vision that is now recognized as one of the greatest films of all time. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kip Stratton. Hi, Kip. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you're having a very busy time getting ready for the upcoming release of the book, so I'm glad we had time to talk.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot going on right now. I've been delighted by the level of interest that's being shown by across the country and, in fact, around the world with this book's release. There are many, many people to whom The Wild Bunch is a significant part of their life, at least in terms of their artistic life and what they like to see in terms of movies. So there's a lot going on, and it's very gratifying.
Well, I've hosted this podcast for nearly 5 years, and my favorite books are always those that are devoted to a specific film or film series. So yours is a great example of this, and there are plenty of them out there, and I've interviewed a number of interesting authors, but yours is one that is definitely a cut above many of the ones that I've read in the past. But let's start to deal with Sam Peckinpah first, his background. Why is he considered such an important filmmaker, particularly in the period when The Wild Bunch was released?
It's a funny irony there, in a way. Sam Peckinpah went on record as saying that he thought, and I'll clean this up a little bit, he thought that the auteur theory of filmmaking was excrement, shall we say. And and the irony there is, of course, he was one of America's great auteur filmmakers. The thing about Peckinpah that really matters from a film point of view is that starting with Ride the High Country and then ending with Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Peckinpah directed a cycle of films that makes a really profound auteuristic statement, I think. And there are very few filmmakers who have come up in America that we can say that about. L.Q. Jones, who was in more films with Peckinpah than any other actor, told me once, he said, look at John Ford's films. And he said, you know, he maybe directed 200 movies. I don't know how many he actually directed. And out of that, maybe four, maybe five are masterpieces. He said Peckinpah directed around a dozen films, but out of those, four or five are maybe masterpieces. And so he didn't have a great volume of films he directed compared to Raoul Walsh, for instance, or Howard Hawks, or Ford and John Huston, going down the line. But he did make these interesting statements in his films that are cohesive, I think, and enlightening, and also just are highly have a high achievement of art. And so that's why he matters as a director. Now, Peckinpah is also a fascinating personality. And, you know, the first book published by a New York publisher about Sam Peckinpah was entitled Bloody Sam. And it had very little to do with his artistic achievements, and had a great deal to do with the stories that were told about his wild behavior and so forth. So there is kind of a almost Pyrrhon interest in Peckinpah, who had a lot of difficulties as a human being. He was severely alcoholic, of course, and then acting on the advice of his good friend James Coburn in the mid-70s, he tried to use cocaine to curb his alcohol intake. And rather than curbing his alcohol intake, it, you know, kind of created a monster in some ways. But so there were all these parts of him that were outrageous. But he was, as Monty Hellman told me, a guy who at his core was really a sweet guy. It's just so many layers you had to go through to get to the sweet guy part. So that those aspects of his personality make him fascinating. And a lot of people are interested in that too. Now, he was a major director at a time that's come to be called in some quarters America's second golden age of film, that period that's bracketed more or less by the release of Bonnie and Clyde in 1967, and then kind of ended with the advent of big budget special effects films. A lot of people would say it ended with the release of Star Wars in, what was that, 1976 or 77, somewhere around there. Okay, 77. So about a 10-year period that we had that second golden era, in which there was money, usually not a great deal invested in them, but there was money available for some really interesting directors and interesting actors, interesting screenwriters to pursue films that otherwise, you know, would not be made. And a lot of that money dried up after the in the late 70s. But, you know, I think if you think of Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, that ended that kind of cycle of Peckinpah's. I think it was Billy Bob Thornton who once said, you know, if you were sitting around a room talking to some people about what you might want to come up with for an idea to make a movie, that's probably not going to be it. You know, it's a pretty far out there picture in terms of what you might think would be an appeal at a box office, but you could do that during that time. And a lot of people found money to do it, made some very interesting films. And as I said, Peckinpah was one of the great directors from that time period, you know, along with Robert Altman and a few other names. So there's a lot about Peckinpah that's compelling. I went into this book thinking at that point there had been about three dozen books written about Peckinpah. When I got started on this, I was thinking, well, gosh, is there anything new to explore? Well, I found out there's a whole bunch of new stuff to explore. And I think that's the appeal of him, too, is he's sort of an unfolding bud continuously. We always find out something new or see some new perspective about what he did.
Of course, this is actually not the first author I've talked to about a Peckinpah film. A while back, I talked to Paul Sador about his book, Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, The Untold Story of Peckinpah's Last Western Film. So, believe it or not, I'm not a stranger to hearing his story, Peckinpah's story.
Well, of course, Paul is a good friend of mine. We met through this process, and he was extremely supportive of my writing this book, and he opened many doors for me. And we, like I say, we become friends on a personal level as well. He's an extremely important critic, I think, when you look at the books he's published. You know, the thing about criticism, there are people who will disagree with some of what a critic writes. But I think that even if you disagree with some of the assessments, you look back at the thought and the writing that goes into it. And Paul is a true film scholar, both with the book you mentioned and then also with the Western films, Reconsideration, which is must reading for anybody who is interested in Peckinpah. Both for Paul's scholarly perspectives, but also he's a good reporter. He found out things about the Peckinpah family that he reports in that book that you know had not appeared elsewhere. So his Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid book is something that everybody has to read who's interested in Peckinpah's films.
So what decided to, what drew you to want to write about this film? Obviously, it's the 50th anniversary of its release, but your introduction talks a little bit, and you and I are close to the same age, except you went the Western way and I went other ways in my early film viewing. But what led you to decide this was something you wanted to write about, especially since you haven't really written about film before, at least in your books?
That's correct. I have not written about film in my books. I did take a lot of film courses, though, when I was in college. So, and it's been a passion of mine, particularly Western films, have been a passion of mine for all my life. And it, as you know, we mentioned, you and I are about the same age. I was a kid growing up in a small town in Oklahoma, and it could be pretty oppressive in those small town atmospheres if you are someone who has a literary bent or, you know, just curious about bigger things in life. And the two avenues of escape for me were the public library and then two motion picture venues in my town. One was the theater in town, the Melba Theater, and then there was a drive-in theater on the outskirts of town, and I saw many, 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 many pictures in there and just got really hooked into film that way. So I saw, you know, I was young during that second golden era of Hollywood film, so I saw many interesting pictures at the Melba Theater in Guthrie, Oklahoma. You know, I saw things like Five Easy Pieces and Monty Hellman's Two Lane Blacktop and so forth, which at the time I just took, you know, for granted, oh, we got a lot of films like this that are always going to be around. I didn't realize it was a special period. But I did see Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch when I was 13 years old. And it, that's a heck of a film to see when you're that age. And particularly in that period in American history where film standards were quite different from what they are now and what you can portray in a film. This pushed a lot of boundaries and actually went over a whole lot of boundaries. And so it left a real memory for me. And then later on, I thanks to the VHS revolution, which I guess really got going in the kind of the mid-1980s in a big way, I suddenly was able to see a whole bunch of Sam Peckinpah films, things like The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which I'd never seen before. And so I developed this real interest in Peckinpah as a filmmaker through that. I also started reading the books about him. And then, I don't know, I finished a book about the former heavyweight champion boxing champion Floyd Patterson, and was kind of kicking around different ideas about what I wanted to do next in terms of a book. And something just from the subconscious kept telling me that there was another book to be written about Peckinpah, and I was trying to figure it out. I wasn't sure what it was. And as I mentioned in my introduction, the woman who cuts my hair is also a Reiki master, and she did this little thing on me. And she said, you know, there's some guys dressed like soldiers. They're not like Civil War soldiers, but they're not modern soldiers. And they're really getting shot all up and all of this. And she said, you know what that's about? And I thought, you know, I said, no, I really don't. And I was kind of concerned that she was able to see that in my aura or whatever they do. But then, not long after that, it just clicked. The 50th anniversary of the Wild Bunch was coming up, and that there was a kind of mainstream book to be written about that movie. In addition to the many, many good books of scholarly work that have been done, Paul Cedar for one, Michael Bliss, others. And I decided to explore that, and then things just started falling into place. And so that's sort of how it came about. And it was a great experience in the sense that for this book, I was really able to pour a lot of my passions into it. And it stands now, you know, again, you're my age, so maybe you can appreciate this a little bit. You know, this is the book that now that it's about to be published, I feel like I could die tomorrow and have accomplished something and left it behind. So those are the things that were all at play with me. So that was the genesis of this. And like I say, then it just became a work of a great passion. I got so many good interviews and so much help from so many people. It was, in that regard, by far the easiest book I've ever written. Anyone I wanted to interview, I was able to interview, with the exception of, for whatever reason, Bo Hopkins never returned any of my inquiries. And I was disappointed about that, but maybe he had a lot going on. And I had a lot of good material about him I'd found from some other sources. So it wasn't a huge thing. But other than that, everybody I contacted helped me out. Even people who had not spoken about the movie maybe ever in some cases, or had decided not to talk about it anymore. They wanted to tell me their story one more time. So it was a great experience all the way around. Now, I did end up having so much material that it was a challenge to try to figure out what to include and not include in order to get some kind of narrative line going in the book. But it all came together.
That's good to hear. And I was going to even ask you about that, but you've already answered it. Like we said before, I mean, I was 13 in 1969 as well. But for me, the movie wasn't The Wild Bunch. It was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which came out later that year. And what I found interesting in watching The Wild Bunch recently just to prepare, there are similarities, not in tone, obviously, but there are similarities between the two films. Because they were both looking at the concept of Old West characters trying to make one last score before retiring. Was there awareness between Peckinpah or the studio with the production of Butch Cassidy that was going on at the same time?
Absolutely. The Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid screenplay by William Goldman had hit Hollywood in the way that I'm not sure any original screenplay ever had before. There are people to this day who will tell you it's the best screenplay ever written. I don't know. I think Peckinpah and Waylon Greene did quite a majestic job with The Wild Bunch, but there's certainly Chinatown and any number of others. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, it stirred up a lot of interest in Hollywood, and it became you know, on people's lips. And so there was an effort on the part of Warner Brothers and producer Phil Feldman to try to get The Wild Bunch into theaters before Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, to try to cash in, if you will, a little bit on all of the interest they thought was being stirred by this whole project. And they were successful in that. I think The Wild Bunch came out in June of 69, and I think Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid came out in the early fall, if I remember correctly. So that they did do that, and you know, there was some interest in exploiting the name The Wild Bunch, because that was one of the names of the Butch Cassidy gang. It was the Hole in the Wall gang, but sometimes called The Wild Bunch. So they kind of thought, okay, we can cash in on this too, but let's get it in the theater first in order to do that. So there was very much a kind of competition in that regard to try to, for Warner Brothers to get their picture out first. And as it turns out, that was, kind of the last great year for Westerns. You know, certainly you had John Wayne's film True Grit that came out in 69. You had Sergio Leone's film Once Upon a Time in the West hit America in 1969. There's any number of terrific films, even Easy Rider, which Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper decided from the beginning was going to be a kind of Western with cowboys on motorcycles. And they even, you know, the names of the characters are Wyatt and Billy from Wyatt Earp and Billy the Kid. You know, I don't know that Fonda's character ended up ever being called Wyatt in the film. Maybe he did. But, and if you look carefully, you even see Fonda on his motorcycle boots is wearing some spurs at times, you know. So it's so very much a year of Westerns, and the big magnet of them all, of course, was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which went on to be the top grossing film of the year. So it was 69 ended up being the last great year of the Western.
So in watching, I mean, there are obvious differences, like I say, not just for obvious reasons. The tones are completely different. We only have really one major scene of violence in Butch Cassidy where the Wild Bunch is quite, it's bookended by huge gunfights with depiction of violence that was obviously unusual even at the time, even though, as you pointed out, it was already after the release of Bonnie and Clyde. But I noticed that the film almost had a European tone to it. I guess I'm not sure exactly even how to describe that, but the quick cutting, the slow motion, I mean, it's... You could tell that nowadays, I think most people wouldn't be obvious to them, but knowing the films of the period, it's clear that it is so different from the other movies that were coming out. What kind of influences did Peckinpah have that might have affected his style?
Sam was much more influenced by European directors and by Kurosawa than he was by, you know, Raoul Walsh or Howard Hawks or some of the great names of American directors. He studied foreign films carefully, and he went on record more than once saying he thought Kurosawa's Rashomon was the greatest movie ever made. He was particularly impressed by Fellini's work. And there were films coming out of the French New Wave that influenced him too, in particular the use of slow motion and some of the editing techniques. So, and you know, he was he appreciated what Sergio Leone was doing with the trilogy with Clint Eastwood. At that point, Sam had seen A Fistful of Dollars, we know, and he listed it as an influence on the film. So he had this, I think, through watching the Leone films and through other things, plus his own growth, I think he had this interest in using some of the new wave filming techniques and other international films that he watched in creating The Wild Bunch. I even see the way some of the shots are set up. I even see the influence of some of the Mexican film directors, including El Indio, Emilio Fernandez, and that. So I know Peckinpah watched a lot of international films, and it certainly shows up in the way The Wild Bunch is textured, I think, and in the shot selection, and in the editing in particular. It is very much a world film, not necessarily an American Western. And to that extent, it's an extraordinary and groundbreaking accomplishment.
One of the other, well, obviously, as you said, it was a world film. Most of it was filmed, I mean, it was filmed in Mexico, and a good portion of the film takes place in Mexico. So that's not a real surprise. He clearly felt that that was an important aspect of what he was trying to show. The film has a distinct relationship to actual history, and I've seen that in other things that he's done. For example, in this one, we've got the Mexican Revolution, the fact that there are Germans in Mexico at this point, and that's something probably most people don't even think about or don't even know about. And this is just before World War One breaks out, and or right around the time of World War One. Was he known for trying to include actual events or people in his films?
I don't know that he was so much outside of two films. The Wild Bunch is one in which the characters are all fictionalized, but it is very much drawn from the Mexican Revolution in a realistic way. And then, of course, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, where he dealt with his take on a real life set of circumstances. And also, as much as he could, given the budget he had, the World War II film he shot in Yugoslavia that's unfortunately underappreciated in the United States, and that's Cross of Iron. I wished a lot more people had seen that movie. But something like The Getaway or Junior Bonner, all of that. Well, now I'm contradicting myself, I guess. Junior Bonner was almost cinema verite. It was shot in Prescott, Arizona during Prescott Frontier Days, an actual historic rodeo in the United States. And if you see that, there's a whole cinema verite element shot during the actual parade for the rodeo and so forth. So there are those realistic elements in that movie too. So maybe I'm contradicting myself as I talk myself through this. He was not a director who was interested in fantasy. For instance, he turned down the opportunity to direct the first Superman movie, which was a huge blockbuster, of course, in order to make Cross of Iron. And ultimately, Cross of Iron was an art film and a very good one. And Superman was ultimately very well crafted fluff. I mean, it was a comic book story. And he didn't have much interest in that kind of thing. He wanted to make things realistic and meaningful in some way.
So, speaking of studios, though, he made the movie for Warner Brothers, and we've talked a little bit about this being pretty much the end of the studio system by this point, although it was still sputtering along, and you still needed them in many ways for certain, you know, for financing and things. But so he made the movie for Warner Brothers. What kind of reaction was he getting from the studio, both during the filming as well as the final cut?
Well, it's a complicated story. Warner Brothers had undergone a significant change. It had Jack Warner had outstayed his time as the mogul in charge of the studio, and had, you know, gone into some risky financial propositions that he couldn't get himself out of. And so the people that had lent him money told him it was time for him to sell his shares in the studio and let someone else take over. And it was a company called Seven Arts that used some money from, questionable sources, I think, and took over the studio, ownership of the studio, by buying out Jack Warner's shares. So there was a time for about a couple of years when the studio was owned by Seven Arts and became Warner Brothers Seven Arts. And the head of production, a guy named Ken Hyman, was a huge Peckinpah fan. And he basically supported Sam throughout The Wild Bunch, even when Peckinpah's producer, Phil Feldman, had differences with what Peckinpah was doing with the picture. It all came back to Hyman in Burbank saying, no, let the big horse run. And he backed Sam all the way. It's the only time I know of where Sam had that kind of backing from a major studio. And he was able to get what he wanted. He got the cast he wanted. He got the crew he wanted. And they gave him plenty of wiggle room in terms of the schedule and the budget in order to get the footage he wanted. And he it's the only time he sought to shoot something really big, like some of those scenes are like David Lean-like film scenes, you know, they're hundreds of people in them, a lot of horses, massive set. And he was able to do it, and the studio backed him. He had this great relationship with Warner Brothers all the way until 1969, when the film was released. And reacting to exhibitors, who at that time, exhibitors were the small town motion picture theater owners and companies that owned the chains and all of that. There was no streaming. There were no home video of any kind at that time. So the exhibitors had huge sway with the studios, and they wanted The Wild Bunch to be shortened so they could get in an extra showing every day. And they did that. And Phil Feldman cut the film without consulting Peckinpah and cut out some scenes that Peckinpah thought were essential to the film, and lessened it. But that kind of ended the romance at that point. By that point, Ken Hyman's father, Elliot, who actually had purchased the studio, had decided to sell it to a conglomerate for a profit. And that seems to have been the plan all along, is to move in, hold it for a couple of years, and sell it for a profit. And so that also ended the romance of Warner Brothers with Peckinpah. The new owners had no interest in continuing a relationship with him. They had other ideas. So it was good while it lasted, and it allowed him to make this magnificent picture. And but it was really the only time he had that kind of support from a major motion picture studio.
You talk in the book about him being blacklisted before this, not as we talk about the political blacklists that were going on in the 50s and early 60s, but what were some of the reasons that studios didn't want to work with him going into this film?
Well, he, on the filming of Major Dundee in Mexico, there were, it was a disaster from the word go. Sam was still in his 30s at that point and had a couple of motion pictures and a lot of TV experience behind him, but he was trying to make an epic with huge stars and plans at one point that this would be a road show, you know, with an intermission and everything. This would be big. And he did not have a lot of experience as a director at that point. And so he made some mistakes. He didn't have the script in the shape it should have been in when he started production. He made some serious mistakes in terms of choosing locales in which to shoot, some of them hundreds of miles apart. And then, you know, this was a huge company with a lot of actors, a lot of crew, and a lot of animals. And so on. And then at the same time, the studio, Columbia, was going through its own difficult period. And Harry Cohn was dead. New owners were in. And they made a decision that they wanted to change the focus of Major Dundee from this roadshow epic to being another Western, just another Western they could package up and ship out to the U.S. and Europe and return a profit. So the pressure became from Columbia to change things, yet Sam was resolute in pursuing his vision as a filmmaker. And, you know, in my mind, he's sort of a poet who, you know, dealt with visual metaphors as opposed to written ones. And so this great conflict developed between the studio and Sam over Major Dundee. The studio was dispatching suits down there to try to intimidate him to make progress. And then the producer got so angry at him that he essentially took the film away from him after production had stopped. Sam wasn't involved in the cutting. And the producer began trashing Peckinpah to other people. I mean, Hollywood, especially in those days, and this is still true, it's in this massive city, Los Angeles, but Hollywood is kind of a small town. And if you know small town dynamics, it's one of the things is everybody knows everybody else's business. And in the film world, that's very much true. And if you are a powerful studio head or a studio executive of some sort, and you want to trash somebody's reputation, you can do it. You can get on your Rolodex and start talking to people. And so that's really where this blacklisting started, was with the experience on Major Dundee, and then the failure on Cincinnati Kid. And at that point, there was this accusation he was trying to shoot unauthorized nude scenes for Cincinnati Kid and all of this. And it just, the word spread, and no one would hire him. You know, the word was he's difficult, he's unreliable, he's not a team player, so you don't want him in the director's chair. And this, again, was at a time when the studio system was collapsing, and a lot of these people were dealing with a lot of pressure from financial backers. They wanted, who all, of course, wanted return on their investments in the business and in individual pictures. And so it was this whole rocky situation with the studios contributed to it too. He was seen as not being the kind of guy who could understand what they were dealing with as well. So he went through this period in the mid 60s where no one would hire him to direct. Now, one thing Peckinpah was very good at always was scripting. He learned how to write teleplays first by adapting radio scripts for Gunsmoke into 30-minute TV episodes. And so from that foundation, he learned how to write scripts very well. In fact, one of the things I discovered in writing my book is that he was Sid Field's mentor. Now, Sid Field wrote the best-selling book Screenplay, which is, you know, has been a huge influence on how screenplays are written since its appearance. But this whole notion of how a movie is constructed, Sid Field learned from Sam Peckinpah at a time when Peckinpah was doing writing on the Wild Bunch script. So very much if you see a production that was had a connection to Sid Field's books in the writing of the screenplay, well, then it's actually, if you go back to Degrees of Separation, it all goes back to Peckinpah and what he was doing on the Wild Bunch. But he was always in demand as a writer. And then a TV producer took a chance on him to adapt and then direct a 60-minute TV movie, if you will, based on Katherine Ann Porter's short novel, Noon Wine. And it was extremely successful. Won Sam some awards. It got him a lot of attention. And then when the Hyman family took over leadership of Warner Brothers, Ken Hyman had seen Ride the High Country, Sam's great Western with Randolph Scott and Joel McRae. And he knew Sam was sort of a cutting edge kind of guy at a time when they were trying to reach out to baby boomer audiences, and he's kind of edgy. And Ken Hyman said, I think I want to work with this guy. And he brought him into the Warner Brothers fold. But there was that 18-month to 2-year period where Peckinpah was sure he would never direct a film again. And he'd have to get by doing script doctoring and things like that to survive.
It's interesting because one of the things I was going to ask you about, and you actually sort of talked about it already, the most current home video versions of Wild Bunch identified as being the director's cut. And that means different things at different times, but you've pretty much explained it. This was the version that was appearing in the United States was one that was shorter by about, I think I just read 10 minutes in order, as you point out, to be able to show it more often during the daytime. But luckily, the complete print was in existence, so it wasn't that difficult to bring it out. So it's probably not the first time or the last that something like that happened.
Yeah, in this case, the complete print, which and Sam was fine as it was originally released by Warner Brothers. He objected to the cuts that were made in order to appease American exhibitors. But the long version, if you will, was the only version that ever played in Europe. And it's also, I know a friend of mine saw it while he, in 1969, he was living in South America. And that was the version, the long version that he saw in South America. So it was around. It never really went away outside of the United States, but here we had to wait until, what was it? The early 90s, I guess, before the home video version included what was called the director's cut, quote unquote, but it was just really the original released version of it.
Right. Besides, interviews, which you obviously had many, what kind of other sources did you have access to? Were there written sources or records from the making of the film that were available to you for this?
You know, Sam Peckinpah, I'm not quite sure how this happened exactly. Peckinpah was, you know, didn't seem like the most organized person in the world. You know, drinking a lot. He was in all these different romantic relationships. His life was almost always a mess. However, he somehow managed to keep meticulous archives. the Margaret Herrick Library at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has dozens and dozens and dozens of boxes of archives related to Peckinpah. Every memo, every letter, it just goes on and on. So I spent a lot of time in Beverly Hills at the Herrick Library looking at all this material, including the memos related to the Wild Bunch, both before and during and after production, the call sheets, everything is right there. And it always seemed to be the supreme irony to me that given the mess that Peckinpah was in his personal life, that this magnificent archives exists there at that library. You even find things that just delighted me, like when he went on the Warner Brothers payroll, there was immediately a letter from the IRS telling Warner Brothers they were going to impound his salary for so many weeks because of unpaid back taxes and things like that, you know, and that degree of detail, which to a writer such as myself, that's just gold. It's just gold. And it's sort of like the Norman Mailer archives at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, which even includes things like matchbook covers on which Mailer wrote down the names and phone numbers of different waitresses he met in bars. They're still in that. So if you're a writer of the bent of someone like myself, you find these archives that are that detailed in what their holdings include are just absolute gold.
One of the good things that I have seen in doing these interviews, since so many of them are built around people researching, is the fact that universities and other institutions they want to keep these archives now, not even just Hollywood, but I mean, all over the country, there are archives for various filmmakers and films. And the fact that they exist is what's making these books become so interesting, because you can literally find incredible amounts of information. And it just definitely helps in understanding the films and the filmmakers better.
Well, one thing that I wrote about extensively in my book is this amazing contribution made to the Wild Bunch by Mexican and Mexican-American people who were working as crew members, as actors, and so forth. One of the most important people on this production was a guy I got to meet over the phone, still living, exactly Sam Peckinpah's age. He's in his 90s. Chalo Gonzalez, who, for all intents and purposes, became kind of the production manager once they got to Mexico, because he was the one who knew how to deal with Mexican governmental people, Mexican unions, and so forth. But I kept finding these emails written by Phil Feldman that were critical of Chalo Gonzalez. And I kept thinking, what's this about? So then I just dug deeper and deeper and discovered that there was real resentment on the part of some of the, especially the older white Americans who were in Mexico working on the picture, and the amount of trust that Peckinpah had given to Chalo Gonzalez to get things accomplished. But on the other hand, you say, yeah, I understand why. Chalo Gonzalez did all the groundwork to get the locations. He was the guy who found the contractors to build the bridge that was blown up. He was the guy who even found the train used in the train robbery scenes. And so it's as I say, I found this information that was really interesting about Mexicans and Mexican Americans in this picture. And I think one of the key things about the Wild Bunch to keep in mind, as far as I know, this was the first major American picture that had a lot of roles in it that were people who were supposed to be Mexican, from Mexico. And every actor and actress who appeared in one of those roles was Latino. And in fact, they were all Mexican or Mexican American, with the exception of Jaime Sanchez, who was Puerto Rican. And that, I think, was a real significant thing about this movie, because if you go back just a year or two earlier, Hollywood was still using white people to play Mexicans in movies. You know, they'd find some guy who was of Italian descent, had dark eyes and dark hair, and say, okay, put some makeup on him, he could be a Mexican. But this movie, and I think a lot of this has to do with Peckinpah's interest in authenticity, really had an all Latino cast for Latino parts. And that's no small thing. And I think that it's something Peckinpah deserves credit for.
And of course, what's also interesting, and it's related to what you just said, is how much of the film is in Spanish during some of these scenes. You don't get Mexicans speaking broken English very often. It's mostly they're speaking what they would be speaking at the time.
There's a sequence that lasts about 2 minutes involving the confrontation between Jaime Sanchez's character Angel and his former girlfriend Teresa. Mm-hmm. And if you that scene is all done in Spanish, but they Sonia Emilia played Teresa and Jaime Sanchez were such good actors that even though it was all in Spanish, for people who didn't know any Spanish, you still knew what they were saying to each other, and you still realized the import of that. And what a great actress she is. She's still very much alive and very active. She made a decision to focus on music instead of acting, so she hasn't appeared in films at all. But I interviewed her. I'm the first person to interview her about The Wild Bunch and her experiences in it. But she was so talented. There's that facial expression when that confrontation, she's both sad and angry and ends it with that kind of maniacal laugh. And there's so many different emotions conflicting with each other on her face during that brief sequence, that it's extraordinary acting and extraordinary filmmaking, I think, and that whole thing. But it was really lovely communicating with her, and she's so proud of her work in that movie.
Well, I think there are so many things in that film, or so many things to talk about in that film, and your book is just a wealth of information that I hope not only should people read the book, which is obvious, but if you haven't seen The Wild Bunch, or if it's been a long time since you've seen it, watch it. I think it's almost a good idea to watch it before you read the book. Just make your own impressions, get your own ideas of what you think, because one of the things I felt was, in reading the book then, I said, well, yeah, I did see that correctly, or I did understand that correctly, or the way that it seemed like it was supposed to be. So this is a perfect way for, especially like we said this year, the 50th anniversary, to honor what Peckinpah did with this film. So I really appreciate the work you did on this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was a labor of love, and I'm just happy I had this opportunity to do it.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I know, like we said before, you're going to be quite busy. So I hope people get a chance to look and see if you're even going to be in their area, because you're going to a couple of different places. A lot of it, you live in Austin, right? And you're going to be appearing down in that area, but you are actually going in a couple other locations.
Yeah, so far we have about 10 locations. I'm going to be in Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, Tucson, Austin, San Antonio. We got something in the works for Houston and Dallas, and also Oklahoma City and Tulsa. And I'm working on something for Denver, so I'm gonna be traveling around a good bit. And I'm also going to Norway in the spring, where, you know, Peckinpah is highly, highly regarded as a filmmaker in Europe. And I've been asked to speak at the University of Bergen, so about Peckinpah and the Wild Bunch. So I'll even be crossing the pond.
Sounds great. Well, thank you for joining me. I really, really enjoyed our conversation and about a really great film that deserves its constant acclaim.
Well, thank you. This has been wonderful. And again, thanks for having me.
My great thanks to Kip Stratton for his time. Given its golden anniversary, you will likely hear quite a bit about The Wild Bunch in 2019, and I hope you read this book to learn how it came about. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.